Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. It's been quite a week on Capitol Hill, starting with Republicans backtracking on their vote to rein in the Office of Congressional Ethics, then dueling press conferences yesterday with President Obama and Vice President-elect Mike Pence talking about the future of the Affordable Care Act. Republican Congressman Mark Wayne Mullen represents Oklahoma's 2nd District. More than 130,000 Oklahomans buy their health insurance through Obamacare, and more than 85% of those people receive subsidies to help pay for it. Congressman Mullen wants a swift repeal of Obamacare, and he joins us now via Skype. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
It's great to have you. First of all, let's start off with where the week started off in Congress. I'm just curious, on Monday, when congressional Republicans held that closed-door meeting and discussed and voted on making significant changes to the Congressional Ethics Office, how did you vote?
Well, first of all, it wasn't necessarily closed door. It was our conference. It was just a regular conference rules meeting that we have on a regular basis. But the start of every conference, we have to vote on the rules that's going to control the House. And since 2008, roughly, they've investigated over 160 cases. They referred 65 to House Ethics, and only 6 has been picked up. A few actually ended up in prison, such as Jesse Jackson Jr. The problem is we're spending $1.4 million with OCE, and the argument is, are they needed? We're trying to find a more effective way to run government, and right now, I don't know if OCE is needed, so I voted to get rid of them. However, I do believe that ethics is obviously something that we all should be held to a higher standard. We're elected officials.
Well, if I understand correctly, you are actually one of 6 lawmakers who are currently under investigation by the Office of Congressional Ethics for the investigation is about private income while in Congress and making commercials endorsing your family's plumbing business. That's still currently under investigation?
Well, it's my company, my wife mm-hmm. and I's company, that we've had since I was the age of 20. And the question is, are we still allowed to be citizen legislators? Define citizen legislator, and if I don't fit that bill, if a plumber, if a contractor, if someone has been self-employed for 15 years before I got up here, somehow can no longer be involved in my company, something's inherently wrong with the term citizen legislator at that point.
Well, let's turn now, Congressman, to health care, because, of course, also on the Hill this week, we heard a lot from both members of Congress and President Obama and Vice President-elect Mike Pence on the future of the Affordable Care Act. Now, I'm seeing that some 130,000 Oklahomans have received or purchased health care, individual health plans through the Affordable Care Act. If the ACA is indeed repealed, what do you have to say to those 130,000 Oklahomans who could stand to lose their health insurance?
Well, we're bringing back the opportunity for the private companies to be involved. Right now, because of the Affordable Care Act, it's ran insurance companies out of business. Right now, there's only one company that's left that they can get insurance through the Affordable Care Act, and that's Blue Cross Blue Shields. This year alone, Blue Cross Blue Shields has had a 76% increase. That's just this year. What we're going to say to those individuals is that over 135,000 is that we're going to bring down the cost of health care, bring in the entrepreneurs again, the private companies, get government out of the way and allow our health care system to work like it should.
If I could just jump in here, because we were looking at the health care marketplace in Oklahoma. And yes, right now it's just Blue Cross Blue Shield that's offering plans through the Affordable Care Act. But they had 95% of the market anyway. And as for those 76% average rate increase, that was definitely by far the highest in the country for 2017. But when you factor in the tax credits that come along with the ACA, you know, we were looking at, for example, the second lowest cost silver plan. Looks like after the tax credit, basically folks eligible for it are not seeing any increase in their premiums.
Yes, there's such thing as tax credits, but there's still nothing for free. There's still a huge amount of increase. What about for those people that don't qualify for the tax credits? the individuals that retired, and they retired pretty well off, but maybe not as well off as they would like, they've seen a 76% increase, but they make too much money for the tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
Those individuals are being hurt. We are trying to bring the free market back to healthcare.
But there have been studies, one out of Georgetown University in 2012, that found out that in states where, for example, where they allowed out-of-state insurers to come in into their local markets, into their state markets, and they opened the state lines, essentially, no insurer came in. Zero. Zero of them came in because it was just too expensive for them to set up their new networks in these states. So when given the opportunity to compete, insurers decline that. So isn't that kind of a problem?
Well, I'm not saying that I'm in a healthcare business. Unfortunately, I have entered into it by being a member of Congress. That doesn't make me an expert into it. But I do know for a fact, Obamacare is driving up costs each and every day. If we create an environment for competition to come back in and thrive, we will see that the private sector will bring down cost. We just always do. It's what happens.
Well, Oklahoma Congressman Mark Wayne Mullen, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on, and I'd be welcome to come on anytime.
Sheriff Thomas Hodgson wants to help Donald Trump build that wall the president-elect wants on the border of the U.S. and Mexico. Actually, the sheriff wants his inmates to help build it. Hodgson is the sheriff of Bristol County in Massachusetts, and he's kicking off a national effort to have prison inmates construct the proposed wall, that is, if Donald Trump will have them. Hodgson made his announcement last night at his inauguration. Shannon Dooling from Here and Now contributor WBUR was there.
The swearing-in ceremony for Sheriff Thomas Hodgson was complete with color guard and bagpipes, setting a formal tone for the evening. Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker introduced Hodgson, applauding his long public service record, his loyalty to upholding the law, and his transparency.
I've always admired the fact that no one ever had to doubt where Tom was coming from on any particular issue that he faced here as sheriff or when he served on the city council.
Sheriff Hodgson is known for speaking his mind and not shying away from politically hot topics. In fact, the longtime Republican has made a name for himself in this blue state by doing just that. Hodgson is a Donald Trump supporter, backing the president-elect's hardline approach to immigration enforcement, including the need for a border wall. The sheriff has also criticized public officials in so-called sanctuary cities for their refusal to fully cooperate with customs enforcement agents. So Hodgson made these issues the focus of a national new proposal, a first-of-its-kind nationwide inmate labor program that he calls Project NICE, or National Inmates Community Endeavors. To kick off the program, Hodgson is offering to send Massachusetts inmates to the country's southern border.
I'm making a formal offer to President-elect Trump that inmates from Bristol County and others from across the nation through Project NICE will help build that wall.
Hodgson did not provide details on how the program would be funded, and he says he's not heard back from Trump's office yet. But he's confident this is something the president-elect can get behind.
I believe that we will have a good partnership with the federal authorities. We don't have a commitment at this point, but I fully expect we will, because it makes all the sense in the world. It's hard to argue, regardless of what the initiative is, whether it's building a wall or it's rebuilding a community after a disaster. It's what government ought to be doing.
The Trump team has not responded to inquiries about Hodgson's offer, but the sheriff does have some national support for his program, which would be voluntary for inmates. National Sheriff's Association Director Jonathan Thompson says his group would back the initiative as long as the federal government does.
What we believe nationally is that it takes a few successful endeavors like this to really create a template, so to speak, to allow sheriffs across the country to engage in something like this and then put it into practice. So we're very pleased to hear that Sheriff Hodgson has come to the plate and come to say, I want to try this.
But in an emailed statement, Governor Baker's office expressed less enthusiasm. Thanking the sheriff for his efforts with inmate work projects in Massachusetts communities, the administration says it would prefer the Bristol County sheriff to, quote, continue to offer those services closer to home. And closer to home is where some people believe inmate work programs belong. Vincent Schiraldi is a research fellow at Harvard Kennedy School and a former probation commissioner in New York City. He values local prison work programs, but questions whether such a national program would be worthwhile. Especially, Schiraldi says, if inmates are being asked to work on politically charged projects like the border wall.
A lot of good could come from having people who have run afoul of the law repay their debt to society by doing works in the community to sort of make reparation. And it's a real shame to start that with probably the most divisive public works project perhaps in the history of America.
While Schiraldi fears that such a program could backfire, alienating prisoners instead of engaging them, Sheriff Hodgson says he can think of no other project that would have as positive an impact on inmates as helping to construct a wall to secure their country. For Here and Now, I'm Shannon Dooling.
Out in paperback this month, Welcome to Night Vale, the novel based on the hugely popular podcast.
Rabbits are not what they seem to be. Welcome to Night Vale.
The podcast is a series of surreal, fictional broadcasts from a community radio station read by station announcer Cecil Baldwin. It's been downloaded more than 100 million times since it first launched in 2012. And last November, we spoke with co-creators Jeffrey Craner and Joseph Fink about Welcome to Night Vale, the book and the phenomenon. I think we should just start off by giving listeners a little more of a feel of Welcome to Night Vale. And here's kind of a typical public service announcement from the podcast.
The city council announces the opening of a new dog park at the corner of Earl and Somerset near the Ralphs. They would like to remind everyone that dogs are not allowed in the dog park. People are not allowed in the dog park. It is possible you will see hooded figures in the dog park. Do not approach them. Do not approach the dog park.
So what is going on in the dog park?
It's hard to say.
Yeah,
it's hard to say.
It?
Just don't think about that so much. You know, it's just a municipal dog park. It'll be fine. What's the worst that could happen?
It'll be fine.
How hard could it be?
What's the worst that could happen? I mean, that's kind of the question, isn't it? Well, so let me ask you, where did the idea for the podcast come from?
You know, Jeffrey and I have been writing together for about 6 years. We wrote a play together and performed it in the East Village, which is where you perform plays. And afterwards, you know, we both really loved podcasts, and I really wanted to do a podcast with Jeffrey, but I didn't want to do one that sounded like any podcast that already existed. And so several months and me getting fired from a job happened, and then I came up with this idea of a weird desert town where every single conspiracy theory is true. Just started writing little bits from that town, not sure what I was doing, and then eventually pieced together that pilot episode just to see if it was even a viable idea.
A lot of the inspiration of Night Vale came out of solo storytelling. Joseph and I have done a lot of work in the theater here in downtown Manhattan, and there's a lot of – you know, here's the thing. When you make theater in performance art and off Broadway in downtown Manhattan, you don't have a lot of money because you're a person who makes theater and you live in New York. And so a lot of times you sort of forego the idea of like sets and costumes and you just rely on your ability to stand in place and tell an audience a good story. And I think that I think that we think about the format of the show as kind of a community radio show because it kind of fits that for a podcast, for an audio-only experience kind of seemed the right kind of format for the show.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to another clip from the podcast because this one has to do with something which seems to be kind of a recurring theme in Night Vale. So let's listen.
Sources say that the used and discount sporting goods store on Flint Drive is a front for the world government. This is based on extensive study of the location and also because it has a black helicopter pad on which black helicopters regularly depart and land. Fairly unusual for a used and discount sporting goods store. We sent our intern, Chad, to try buying a tennis racket and have not heard back from him for several weeks.
Poor Chad. What is up with interns in Night Vale?
You know, interning can be a dangerous job. Mm-hmm. You might have to work long hours for no pay. You might be murdered by the world government. You don't know what's going to happen.
Beware the black helicopters for sure. I mean, I'm just wondering though, I hate to turn this wonderful moment into something a little more serious, but I did hear or read that Joseph, like you went through something of a family tragedy too in before the podcast got launched or sort of in the early days of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of a realization that I only came to recently. But, you know, my father, he had a lot of medical problems for years. And then he died this summer before I started writing Night Vale. And I was also dealing with a lot of anxiety issues at the time. And so I think a lot of Night Vale was me dealing with kind of the combination of grief and anxiety I was dealing with, which led to this town where death and danger is kind of all around, but you have to learn how to live with it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so this is interesting because, I mean, you're doing that in a crafted world where, as you said earlier, every single conspiracy theory is true. So that gives you, I mean, total free range for your imagination. I mean, it's kind of you can't think of a more fertile ground as a writer.
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah, when we started writing the show, when we started writing the first few episodes, we, you know, Joseph and I talked about how we could sort of do anything we wanted here with Welcome to Night Vale. You know, we wanted to stick to a sort of a strict continuity, but you could kind of build out from the idea of conspiracies, like anything could be a cover for something else. Anything could be true and real. And we've kind of taken the approach, not dogmatically, but one of the ways we've approached it has been like taking the absurd and making it mundane, or taking the mundane and making it absurd. So it is kind of interesting to have this small town community radio station just sort of reporting casually about a used sporting goods store being a front for the world government, as casually as it might talk about like the local high school football schedule.
It's that time of year again, listeners. This Friday night is Night Vale High School's homecoming game. I'm not much of a sports fan, but this is the one game I truly care about. All of the Night Vale High alumni come together for it. Everyone, current students, former students, students long dead, future students who aren't born yet. It's the one night we can see our loved ones who have been lost to time and mortality. The dead alumni come out at halftime, and we all get to visit with them while the marching bands go spear hunting for dinner.
I'm wondering, though, are there limits to what can happen in Welcome to Night Vale? I mean, do you ever consider a storyline or an event that you want to write into the podcast, but you think that actually can't possibly happen in this place?
Not really. You know, we sat down early on and we said, you know, it was really actually the first meeting we had about Night Vale. We sat down in a bar to talk through what it would be. The first thing we said was we can do whatever we want. We can go as weird as we want. We can go as poetic as we want, as long as we have continuity. And that was the important thing. As long as the things that happened had weight and continued to affect the world, then you could do anything you wanted within that.
The show's been downloaded more than 100 million times. I mean, why do you guys think it has hit such a nerve?
I think part of it is goes back to why I started writing it in the first place, which is this thing of life is scary. It really is, and it's scary for a lot of people, and that can be hard to deal with. It used to be very hard for me to deal with. And life in Night Vale is very scary. You know, Night Vale is full of conspiracies and literal monsters. But people in Night Vale just get on with their lives. People in Night Vale don't spend a lot of time worrying about that. They just live and kind of whatever happens, happens. And I think there is something very comforting and helpful about that when you're trying to deal with real life. This, you know, in Night Vale, it's alien abductions, and in real life, it's cancer. But both are kind of unknowable and impossible to predict and terrifying. And so having this model of a community that just lives with this stuff and is okay, it's certainly helpful for me to write, you know, for my own life. And I think we've heard from a lot of fans that, you know, they fall asleep listening to Night Vale, which seems odd. You'd think it might be a little creepy, but hearing people be calm around creepiness can be very comforting.
So I want to talk about taking Welcome to Night Vale and putting it into an entirely different medium, into the novel. What were the challenges there?
We obviously, when we write in a new form, we want to think about how that form works. You can't write a novel the same way you write something that's designed for people to listen to. You know, we thought a lot about visual rhythm, you know, sentence length, paragraph length, and how that related to how people read it in a way that we don't have to when writing for audio. The biggest thing that we really had to think through was how to end it, because, you know, the way that a continuing podcast works is it's kind of a juggling act. You're constantly landing stories, but you're at the exact same time throwing more stories in the air, because otherwise you don't have anywhere to go. You always need to have something in the air. But with a book, everything needs to land at the end. You can't leave a bunch of stuff hanging. And so it wasn't like it was an impossible challenge, but it was definitely something new to think through of how do we take everything we've set up in this book and have it all come together in a way we don't have to in the podcast. Yeah.
So finally, I guess I'm wondering, how long can you see Welcome to Night Vale going on for?
I think we can do this as long as it's still fun for us. I mean, the making of Night Vale came out of Joseph and I enjoying working together and wanting to make a thing that we both enjoyed. And the really wonderful part about it is that a lot of other people enjoyed it too. And as long as there are ways for us to keep putting these stories out via podcast or novel or our touring live stage show or whatever it is we're doing, I think we'd want to keep doing that. It's still very fun for us, and there's still so much to do in Night Vale and with Night Vale. So as long as time keeps happening, I think we'll be pretty good.
Unfortunately, or perhaps unfortunately, I don't know, there will always be new conspiracy theories to inspire you.
That's probably a good thing.
Well, Jeffrey Craner and Joseph Fink are the creators of Welcome to Night Vale, the wildly popular podcast, and now the novel. It was really great to talk with both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
The national championship game for college football happens Monday night. Alabama meets Clemson. It's a rematch of last season's title game won by Alabama. The championship contest is the culmination of a 41-game slate of college bowl games this season. And while there are some great games, college football fans did not get to see all the sport's top players because they didn't play. They skipped their games. Sports commentator John Bacon joins us from Michigan Radio. John, who are the big names and why the heck did they not want to play?
And why the heck indeed, Lisa? Well, you've got LSU running back Leonard Fournette, who skipped the Citrus Bowl. You've got Stanford all-purpose back Christian McCaffrey, who skipped the Sun Bowl. And you've got Baylor running back Shaq Linwood, great name, who skipped the Cactus Bowl. And they all did it for basically two reasons. One, those are all pretty low-rent games. As you noted, there are 41 bowl games, so if your team is not on probation, they're probably in one. Low-rent games combined with the fact that they all want to go to the NFL this spring, basically, so they're all getting ready for their pro career and did not want to risk injury. This has raised a few issues, as you might imagine. Some folks calling them traitors and didn't honor your commitment and all that, of course, which is predictable, I suppose. But also, the flip side is, their coaches often leave their teams right after the regular season before the bowl game to make more money somewhere else. So coaches have been doing this for many years.
So coaches can bail out, so why not the players? You're in Ann Arbor,
exactly. Home
to the Michigan Wolverines, where there's a player who did indeed show up. Jake Butt played in Michigan's bowl game, and then?
And then a sad story with Jake Butt, a guy I know quite well here in Ann Arbor. Jake came back for his senior year. He did not have to. He could have graduated on time and all that. Came back, even though it's projected to be a third-round draft pick in the NFL, had a great season. In fact, he was named, he won the John Mackey Award as the nation's best tight end. And yes, you non-football fans, his name is Jake Butt, and he's in fact the nation's best tight end. Not making any of this up, I swear, go look it up. So he had a great season, projected to be a second-round draft pick. And then in the Orange Bowl against Florida State, he suffers an ACL tear, which means he'll probably be dropping from a second-round pick to a fourth-round pick, and that will cost you millions.
So, I mean, this sheds more light on why a lot of players are sitting it out, but I wonder if you could even have imagined 5 years ago that a college player would opt out of strutting his stuff in a big bowl game.
I really couldn't have, and that's how fast, Lisa, things are changing right now. I kind of see it as this big dam that the NCAA has built, with all this money piling up behind it over the years, the last two or three decades especially. On the other side, of course, the players are getting none. So eventually that dam starts to crack. You saw the Northwestern University students, led by Kane Coulter, almost get status as employees from the NLRB. They were taking it seriously. Grambling's players a few years ago refused to play a football game midseason, and the school could not do anything, so they had to cancel the game. So bit by bit, you're seeing players claim more power for themselves. It's not organized. It's not going any one direction. But I think the NCAA better notice one very big thing. These players have no power until they sit down, and then all of a sudden they've got all the power. So they should be watching out.
So they're trying to exert control where they can. Maybe it's an extension, do you think, of the effort a couple of years ago at Northwestern when football tried to unionize unsuccessfully?
It's certainly related. I think it's part of the same basic ethos that you can't always tell us what to do, that the rules might not be as in stone as it appears. So I do think something big is going to change probably in the next few years.
John Bacon, his latest book is End Zone, The Rise, Fall, and Return of Michigan Football. Nice to talk to you, John.
Lisa, always. Thank you.
Most of the focus of the 2016 election was on the race for the White House and the possibility of America electing its first female president. That, of course, didn't happen. In fact, women in general didn't fare much better in down-ballot races. The number of women in Congress remained exactly the same, 104 total in both the House and the Senate. That's just 19% of those bodies. And the number of women governors fell from 6 to 5. But instead of discouraging women, the election seems to have had the opposite effect. Since November 9th, groups that train women who want to run for office have seen a large surge in interest. Andrea Dew Steele is founder of Emerge America, which runs training programs in 17 states for Democratic women interested in running for office. And Andrea, how much of the increase in applications or how much did you see after the election?
Immediately, the day after the election, we had women signing up online for all of our different programs. So now we've had to really increase the number of programs we're doing in each of our states, and it's been really tremendous.
But how much? 10%? 50%? 60%?
Well, in most of our states, it's been at least double.
Were you surprised by that?
I was surprised. I was surprised, of course, by the election results. So I had anticipated that we would have a positive reaction and that women would be inspired by Hillary winning the race. And so I hadn't even thought about what would happen if she didn't win. And then, yes, I was really pleasantly surprised that, you know, instead of hiding under their blankets, women all over the country decided to wake up and run for office and look into running for office. And that was really heartening to me.
Yeah. Because, well, let me just jump in here and ask you because, I asked you about whether or not you were surprised because regardless about how one feels about Hillary Clinton herself, I mean, obviously her gender, you know, for better or for worse, was a part of this election. I mean, obviously for many people, they wanted to see the first woman president, but others, her gender was potentially, you know, a negative aspect, obviously. Her opponent, the now president-elect Donald Trump, used her gender in a negative way, not infrequently during the election. So, I mean, given that, I guess, look, that's my long-winded way of saying, don't you think that it might have been the exact opposite reaction that many women who had been interested in possibly running might have said, well, I'm not going to put myself through that?
I would have maybe thought that. So that's why I think women are extraordinary, because instead of retreating, you know, that's when women said, I have to help my community. I have to get in this. And I think it's really heartening that women responded like this instead of saying, look at this woman who's so extraordinary and she wasn't able to win. That's not the message they took. And I think it's a really amazing sign for the women's movement. I think it bodes well that this is really the start of something very big, much like we saw in 1992 with the Year of the Woman, that we are going to see a real change.
Well, I'm just curious, why is your program only open to Democratic women? Because I'm thinking, you know, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, who's possibly soon to be the U.S. representative to the United Nations, Republican, she's said or been quoted as saying that Hillary Clinton was her inspiration to run for office. So why not open the program to all women, Democratic or Republican, who want to get into politics?
Well, we have a two-party system, and in order to run and win, you have to pick your party. And that's the way it works in this country. And so if you want to be successful, you need to pick your lane, pick your party, and get to know the players in your party at the local and state and national level. That's why we train women in this way, because it works. We have a tremendous success rate. We've trained over 2,000 women. Over 50% have run. Of those, around 70% have won. Just in this election, with Hillary Clinton losing, we had a 70% win rate. So we had 213 women on the ballot. 150 of those women won. So we know what works. Training women in a partisan way, it works because these women are able to connect with the people who are going to help them, and it's going to help them win their races.
Hmm. Let's take a step back here, because what do you think is the primary obstacle right now that women who are interested in politics, regardless of party, that they face when wanting to become politically active?
Well, again, I think the number one issue is that we don't have enough women wanting to run, right? So they don't see politics as an avenue for their community engagement and participation. A lot of women want to affect their community, but we have to show them that politics is an arena in which they want to participate. So that's the number one obstacle. Then after that, certainly for women, it's trying to figure out when is the right time to run. For women who are primary breadwinners, for women who have children or elders to take care of, you know, women have to figure out when is the right time to run. And that's why we encourage our women to step up, to go through our 6-month training to learn the tools to run for office, so that when they are ready and when there is a seat open in their community, because often seats open up very quickly, that they're going to be ready to raise their hand and run for that seat.
Well, how much is it the responsibility of the parties themselves, right? Because they have internal sort of grooming processes and programs. You know, they look around for young political talent and try to get them in at lower level office. I mean, should the parties, let's talk about the Democrats, since that's who you're focused on. Shouldn't the Democratic Party be doing a better job at recruiting women into sort of entry-level off political office?
Well, where we can, we work very closely with our parties. But parties, just like the presidencies and, you know, other offices, they change leadership at least every 4 years. So one thing that we have at Emerge America that's really important is that we have consistency. We have staff on the ground in each of our states, board members, advisory board members, and we have a consistent program that does not change. So you don't have a new party chair who comes in and decides, you know what, recruiting isn't my priority. I'm not going to do that anymore. And that's what happens. So we work very closely with our parties where we can. We actively encourage our women to step up and take roles in the parties. And we are strong believers in building incredibly strong state parties and the national party. We need that to be strong as well.
And you're training women for offices at the local, state, and national level, all levels.
That's correct, at all levels. And there are 520,000 offices in this country. So it's a big, heavy lift. That's why you need more than one entity, more than a party. We need Emerge. We need other organizations, because this is a significant lift.
So tell me, what does the training program look like? What kind of skills, advice, and training do you give?
We start our trainings with the most important aspect, which is public speaking and communication. And we have an emphasis on authenticity. And this is important because we saw in this election that authenticity really matters to voters. And so our women, from the very first day, we train them to connect with why they are running, who they are, why they want to serve their communities. Then we teach them how to fundraise, how to write field plans, every single aspect of running for office.
You know, I should have asked you this quite a while ago. Have you ever run for office yourself?
I have not run myself yet.
I always say what's stopping you?
You never know. So again, just this November, we had 213 women on the ballot. So if I'm able to really leverage my time by getting more women to run all over this country, I think that's the best use right now. But I never say never, and that's what I say when I talk to women about running. I try to get them to go from saying, oh, never, not me, I'm not that kind of person, to maybe someday.
Well, finally, in addition to programs like yours that train and support women who want to run, I'm curious, what else do you think needs to change sort of more broadly about American political culture or our political infrastructure to get more women to run for public office?
Well, we definitely need a stronger support system. So universal daycare, we need paid family leave, all of these kind of programs that other countries have to support women and families more broadly. We really need support for people who are caring for their elders. We really don't have these kind of support systems. So within our culture, our country, we need to do a lot more to support women and families so that individuals can reach their potential. I think that would go a long way to getting more women to step up to the plate and run for office.
Well, Andrea Du Steele is the founder and president of Emerge America, a training program for Democratic women interested in running for office. Andrea, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
The National Atmospheric and Oceanic Administration named 2014 the warmest year ever on Earth. Then it declared 2015 the warmest ever, and 2016 may have set a new record. Climate change is heating things up and causing all sorts of challenges, including for coffee growers who make our morning ritual possible. Reporter Daniel Grossman went to northern Tanzania, where coffee growers are facing weather conditions increasingly unsuitable to growing coffee.
So two of the ladies will show you how they dry the coffee, because the coffee is sun-dried, so we need to turn it in the sun.
Coffee grower Bente Luther Medok explains to tourists how she grows and processes beans at her Machari coffee estate near Tanzania's border with Kenya. Towering above them, the snows of nearby Mount Kilimanjaro sparkle in the sun. On command, the tourists yank on a black tarp, flipping a batch of beans warming under the cloudless sky. They even out the mound of beans by hand.
Coffee is a beautiful product.
German-born Luther Medok hardly fits the stereotype of a hard-nosed overseer. She's dressed in a dainty white blouse and wears her blonde hair in a ponytail. Her estate produces a boutique bean that's praised for its smooth, chocolatey flavor.
My own passion is to do organic coffee. It makes the taste special and different.
In 15 years, Luther Medok has planted 250,000 trees. She says cajoling these trees to produce a good crop is getting harder. This year's harvest was okay, but
we've had the two seasons before that, which were pretty disastrous crop-wise. So that means going down to 50% down, which is really a disaster, yeah.
Coffee has its optimum temperature and optimum rainfall.
Susanna Gastamwambo is a crop scientist at the Tanzania Coffee Research Institute. She says the climate here is changing, making it harder to grow coffee.
There have been severe drought in some areas, and the rainfall are now not reliable.
Did you see this?
Is this tree dead?
Yeah.
So why did they die?
Because of rain. They don't have enough water.
Big plantations like Machari Estate can withstand bad years with help from irrigation systems, savings, and expert advisors. But Melkisevic Mushi, a farmer down the road, isn't so lucky. Like most of Tanzania's coffee growers, he's completely dependent on the weather.
This one, this is the beginning of flower. All this is the flowers.
Now they are waiting for rain.
Mushi is secretary of an 80-member growers cooperative. He owns a spread the size of a football field. It's planted in corn, bananas, and 2,000 coffee trees. Coffee is his cash crop. Several decades ago, when he was young, a wet period of about 2 months, called the short rains, began every October. Flowers burst from buds of well-watered trees, and in time matured into ripe red coffee fruit. Speaking through a translator, Mushi tells me that the short rains can no longer be counted on, and when they do come, they're often too late.
He said that the coffee tree sometimes needs water and sometimes needs sun. So it is only sunny. If it is much drought, the tree must die.
And there's another problem. Coffee trees have to cool off after sunset to thrive. But nighttime temperatures in Tanzania are up nearly 3 degrees Fahrenheit since 1960 and getting hotter. Some farmers might move uphill, but most of the good areas are already occupied or designated as wildlife reserves. So more and more coffee-growing areas will be abandoned. And the same thing will happen in other coffee-producing countries, including Brazil, Kenya, and Costa Rica.
Yeah, so our projections, what they show, that by 2050, at least 50% of the current coffee-growing areas are going to be significantly less suitable to produce coffee.
Peter Laterak is a Swiss climate specialist with the International Center for Tropical Agriculture. He says warming will open up some new areas for growers, but overall the amount of land good for existing coffee strains will decline. And there's also bad news for consumers who start each day with a cup of joe.
This, in combination with increased demand, for, mainly in Asian countries, for coffee, will probably increase the prices for coffee.
For Here and Now, I'm Daniel Grossman.
Dan's story was made possible with support from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.